the book, Your Legacy, is just an outstanding book as well. And I thought this would be a good way to kind of get into, as you can see in our handout today, the changing American family. We've always needed to leave a legacy. We just read that in Psalm 78, right? That is certainly something we should always do, but it's even more so today. And I wanted to take you through some of the sort of sobering statistics on where the family is today. You know, we're all kind of still reeling from the Supreme Court decision recently on same-sex marriage, but the problem with the family goes back a lot earlier than that. And so I wanted to spend some time doing so. And again, since everybody likes freebies, I've read some copies of my book from which this comes from. So I've got a number of copies up here that I'm giving away free to people today. How's that? Pretty good deal. So let's make our way through some of this. And if you look on your handout there, you will see that we'll cover a couple of key points. For those of you that are new to the class, you will see at the bottom of the page there, it says PrestonWoodExamined.org. That means that this presentation, which Parker has posted there, is available to you later on. So if you'd like to listen to it, we will put the audio up there. If you'd like to watch it again, it's there. Or if you have a smartphone or a tablet, you can follow along right now. Just going to go through a few things fairly quickly, because we want to end on time so we can get to the Dallas Museum of Art. Look at, first of all, this conflicting attitudes that Americans have about family and about marriage. Then some changes and trends in marriage and then in family. How we've really, because of that same-sex decision and others, have changed the definition of marriage and family, and then maybe some, so what? What can we do? With me on that? Okay, let's go through this fairly quickly. And the first part is to recognize that if you survey Americans, and I have a lot of this in my book, or you can find this even on our website, you will find that a lot of Americans still feel that family is really important. Better Homes and Gardens did a survey. They found that readers rated their relationship to their spouse as the single most important factor in their personal happiness. A study which I'm going to now spend a little bit of time on, the Mass Mutual study, even though they deal with finances, and I've invested some of my finances with them, they always are looking at what's going on in the culture. And their study on family values reported that 8 out of 10 Americans reported that their families were the greatest source of pleasure in their lives. More important than friends, religion, recreation, or work. So we as Americans still very much value family and see that as very important. But now here's the contrast. And it's what I call the Lake Wobegon effect. Anybody remember Garrison Keillor? You know, all the women are strong, all the men are good looking, and all the what? Children are above average. I use that to say that some people think that all of our families are above average, all our schools are above average, all of our churches are above average. The Mass Mutual Family Study found that a majority pointed to their family as the greatest source of pleasure, but it also found that a majority of Americans rated the family in the United States only fair or poor. Matter of fact, almost 6 in 10 expected to get worse in the next 10 years. And I won't go through the whole survey, but I love the conclusion. They concluded that Americans seem to see the family in decline everywhere, but in their own home. Now, you've seen this before. We're going back to school. Jarrett was just talking about that. If you ask most Americans, do you think public education in America is on a decline? They all say yes. You know, the schools in America are not doing well. But the one my kids go to, well, it's doing just fine, you know. You can oftentimes, with a survey that George Barna did with pastors, have almost all pastors agree that there is a spiritual decline in America, that Christians have a high level of biblical illiteracy. But my church is doing pretty good. And this is the same kind of thing. We all think that families are doing poor, but we feel pretty good about our own family. And I thought that was kind of intriguing about that. They also found in a Gallup poll that Americans believe the family is worse off today than it was 10 years ago. Everybody agree with that? I see some head shaking there on that one. And they believed it would be worse off in the future. Matter of fact, one trend watcher predicted more than a decade ago in an article in American Demographics that marriage would become, in the 21st century, an optional lifestyle. And so this is another reason why we, especially in the church, feel that this issue of legacy, and we can't solve all the problems out there, but at least we can make sure that our families are strong in here. Does that make sense? And really leave a legacy to our children and our grandchildren, or to our nieces and our nephews, or others that are in our community. So let's talk about some of the reasons for those changes and trends. And the reason I'm doing this is to recognize long before we had the legalization of same-sex marriage, we had some other things that were affecting the American family in very significant ways. And let's look, first of all, at changes in marriage. And one of those is you began to see that in America, we actually were postponing marriage. Why did we get baby boomers? Well, there's a very good reason for that. After 1946, we began to have what was known as a baby boom. From 1946 to 1964, we had this mass of individuals, 76 million, born into this world. And they were born into this world because the parents of baby boomers, oftentimes called builders, got married early, had children earlier, and they had quite a number of children. And so this created the baby boom. Well, the baby boom was followed by a baby bust, because the baby boomers now got married later, had children later, and had fewer children. We'll get into all of those right away. But interestingly enough, they did not marry as early as previous generations, and so they postponed marriage until they established their careers. That is relatively unusual, and if you look at the age of first marriage, like in the 19th century, even the early part of the 20th century, very different than the latter part of the 20th century and now in the 21st century. From the 1960s to the end of the 21st century, the median age of first marriage increased by 4 years for men and 4 years for women. If you're a visual learner like I am, there's a graph, and it gives you a pretty good idea. And it shows you that, again, up until 2000, that was going up. But even after 2000, you can see going up to 2010, and after this year finishes, I'll put up the graph for 2015, and it's still increasing. People are getting married later and later in life. And that is certainly one thing that has changed the composition and the nature of families, which we had never seen before. Now, interestingly enough, this has led to a higher percentage of singles as well, because some are postponing marriage so long that they essentially postpone marriage indefinitely. And I used to say when I would teach at Dallas Seminary, if you are preparing your Bible church or denominational church for the traditional American family, think again, because you're going to have a higher percentage in your church than previous graduates of Dallas Seminary ever had of singles in their congregations. And that's something to really think about. Marriage is optional, almost as a perspective that we see in our society today. And interestingly enough, that has led to another phenomenon, the number of so-called live-in relationships who never really joined that issue of marriage. The best way to get a handle on that is to look at the U.S. Census Bureau. And what they do is they ask you, are you married, head of household, married, in a traditional marriage, man living alone, women living alone. If you look at that category of adults living alone, that is one of the faster and has been one of the faster growing demographics in our society. So again, even here at Prestonwood Baptist Church, if you're saying, okay, we're only going to minister to families, well, either you have to define family in a broad way or recognize there are just a lot of people that are singles or single again that we have not really oftentimes in many of our evangelical churches really thought about because of the changing American family. And that gets lumped into a larger category of non-family households, or what the Census Bureau calls non-family families. Leave it to the government to give us non-family families, right? Okay. Within this larger are, of course, singles living alone, but also a lot of individuals living together. And so when you look at these categories, again, this takes us up to 2010, and I'll finish it off at 2015 after this year finishes, you can see the percentage of U.S. households has increased every single year of adults living alone. You know, we are in the open division, and I like that, because we have married, we have single, we have people in all sorts of different age groups. I think that's a really healthy kind of thing. But oftentimes in the churches, if you're in your particular group of individuals, you forget about all the other people that deserve a ministry. And so here, you can see that this is another remarkable demographic that has played itself out here in America. And one of the other reasons why, again, I wanted to help us think about that when we're doing ministry within this church, there are all sorts of different categories that we need to think and break out of the traditional stereotype of father and a mother and kids. You know, that is a case. And, of course, in the 1950s, if you were to turn on a television set, those are the families you would see, right? You know, Ward and Jude and Cleaver and the Beeve, Jim and Margaret Anderson, Ozzie and Harriet Nelson. Remember those? Okay, a few with gray hair or no hair at all agree with me, because some of the younger kids are going, what is he talking about? I have no idea what he's talking about. And what were those? Breadwinner husband, homemaker wife. Dad went off to work. Ozzie never went off to work. I never did figure out what he was, you know. Trivia point, he was an accountant supposedly, but nevertheless, anyway. And it turns out that if you look at the Census Bureau of the 1950s, almost 78% of the individuals that were seen on television existed. You know, you had to add in some that were empty nesters, you know, things like that. But you can see that that was a significant, now less than a majority are in that category of the traditional home. And one of the reasons for the growth is with the issue of adults living alone. Now that, of course, brings us into another issue, and that is cohabitation. I'll use that word. Some people call it living together. Church used to call it living in sin, shacking up. You know, she just popped off of shacking up. But we'll call it cohabitation. And that was one of the other things, is when I started writing about this, recognized that that was another big issue. And it's not just an issue out there. A few times I've been able to teach at a seminary, whether it's been Trinity Evangelical Divinity School or Dallas Theological Seminary or places like that. Oftentimes pastors say, you know, one of the biggest issues I'm dealing with in my church is all sorts of people living together. And so I have chapters in my book on cohabitation. But cohabiting couples change things together dramatically as well. Half of Americans will cohabit at one time or another prior to marriage. Well, that is very different than the world that existed not so long ago. And before you think about that just being, you know, two young singles living together, the traditional stereotype of two young childless couples living together is not completely accurate. Currently, 40% of cohabiting relationships involve children. So again, that's a very different kind of world as well. Some of the best research done on cohabitation were done by David Popino and Barbara Defoe Whitehead at Rutgers University, called the National Marriage Project. Now, I've gotten to know Barbara Defoe Whitehead a little better because, number one, she's been on my radio program. Number two, one of the people that used to be in my Sunday school class at Northwest Bible Church is Richard Defoe, which is how I met them. But if you want to talk about a family, Richard Defoe is a very prominent lawyer here in Dallas. She's, of course, a very prominent scholar at Rutgers University. You may know her brother, Willem Defoe, who is the actor. Remember the actor? And then the other brother, he is a leading surgeon at Mayo Clinic. So Richard, because he's only a lawyer, sometimes says, I hate family reunions. Hey, Willem, what movie are you in right now? Oh, Barbara, what book have you published? I forget the name of the other brother. Whose life did you save today? Yeah, Richard, did you sue anybody? You can just kind of say, but can you imagine what it must be like at a Thanksgiving dinner with that family? But nevertheless, they have found that cohabitation is replacing marriage as the first living together experience for young men and women. You know, if you're ministering to singles, and of course Jared used to, that's something to begin to think about, speaking to that particular issue. And of course, they are the ones that concluded that those who live together before they get married are putting their future marriage in danger. They have been able to document, and again, you got to recognize that these people cannot sign the doctrinal statement of Prestonwood Baptist Church. But nevertheless, they, even though they're pretty secular-minded in terms of what they've done, they have found that if you live together before marriage, you increase the divorce rate by an additional 50%. Because you develop bad habits that oftentimes go into the marriage that cause you to split up. Which is kind of the opposite of what you see right now. Because most people say, well, you know, you wouldn't buy a pair of shoes without trying them on. Wouldn't buy a car without a test drive. Of course, I like to point out that, you know, if you decide not to buy the car's feelings aren't hurt. You don't leave your material and possessions in the trunk of the car and all sorts of other things. But nevertheless, this is another issue that has changed the American family dramatically. And then finally, of course, one other one has been the divorce rate as well. You know, when the divorce rate began to level off in the 1980s, you know, some people began to say, okay, maybe we are no longer a divorce culture because it had increased dramatically. But the cheers turned to groans when they actually realized that the divorce rate was leveling off mostly because people were living together. So cohabitation was the case. So in a sense, the divorce rate was down because the marriage rate was down. And again, if you see those numbers, you can see that there was a remarkable increase in the divorce rate from the late 1960s to 1980. And a lot of that took place simply because of a couple of situations that had changed. One was a change in attitude. The baby boomers tended to be less committed to marriage than the previous generations. Now, some people said it happened because of no-fault divorce. It's pretty good evidence to suggest that the attitude changed the laws, not the laws changed the attitude. In other words, no-fault divorce developed in large part because of individuals that were no longer as committed to one another. And so that was one of those key reasons. And so today we have no-fault divorce laws, which basically say that if one partner wants out of the marriage, that's it. Which again is something else to talk about in terms of the marriage counseling we do here in the church. If both parties are not interested, you can get divorced for any reason or no reason at all. And just one person walking out of there. And so again, we can see that. The other is opportunity. Whereas before some people might, a woman might have been stuck in a situation even with an abusive husband. Now with economic opportunity, sometimes it becomes a little bit easier. But the reality is that with the divorce rate leveling off, it isn't leveling off and actually slightly declining because we're more dedicated to marriage. It's because some people are living together and others are just simply saying they will not tie the knot. By now you're probably saying, you know, these are a lot of topics we never talk about in the church. Would you agree? That's one of the problems. We don't address those issues, and I understand why. We don't want to talk about premarital sex because we don't want to turn off the young people because they'll leave the church. We don't want to talk about living together because we recognize some people in the church are living together. We don't want to talk about divorce because we recognize there are people that are divorced in the church, so we don't want to address any of those issues. So as a result, the church has oftentimes been silent on a lot of those issues. So then along comes what? Homosexuality. And then we say, wait a minute, that's an issue. And they're looking back and saying, well, you can't lecture us about whether the fact we want to get married when you have such a high divorce rate. You see what has unfolded unintentionally because of that. One other one I thought it would be important to mention real quickly, and that is not only see a change in marriage, but we're seeing a change in family. Because as I pointed out, not only do you see that couples are getting married later, but you see that married couples are having children later. And there's some pretty good reasons. Not only did the baby boom generation postpone marriage, but they also postpone procreation. And lifestyle choice was one of those, but just the sheer cost. In my book, I document, and I need to update this now, but back in 1979, if you had a child, they estimated that that child was going to cost you $66,000 before you sent him or her to college. Well, by 1988, they updated that to $150,000, and now that number is almost $250,000. So every child you have is $250,000 investment. Okay, that'll cause you to rethink it. Now let's put this in perspective. Suzanne grew up on a farm, and one of the things I noticed is those Mennonites around there, they have a lot of kids. That's interesting. A lot of kids, not to mention some of the Mormons have a lot of kids, okay, and even some of the Lutherans have a lot of kids. So what's going on? Well, they went back and estimated that if you're an agricultural society, especially before mechanization, so you go back to the early part of the 20th century, every child was a net asset to your inheritance of at least $10,000. Just think about the work that they provided, the food that they created, and at harvest time, you don't dare say I'm bored, right? Because it was all hands on deck. And even to this day, watching her brother and her nephew, and before that, her father, I mean, it's all hands on deck during harvest. So having kids was an economic benefit to your estate in an agricultural society. Today, having kids is a very significant liability. Which is why, again, we need to think about our legacy. Now, there is a couple of places where this trend breaks down. I just mentioned Mormons are one of them, Christians are another. You wouldn't know that we have a declining fertility rate in America if you looked at the nurseries around here. Christians still see children as a gift of God, of arrows in the quiver. But by and large as a society, especially the more secular you are, the less likely you are to have children, which I've talked about before. Christians are having more children, secular people having fewer children. You got to see how that plays out in the next generation as well. More than that, of course, an increasing percentage of women are giving to birth out of wedlock birth. And so again, we see that changing the nature of family, because then the current generation disconnects having children and getting married. In their minds, they separate parenthood from marriage, thus creating an increase in the number of single-parent homes. And we've seen that dramatic one. And even the greater acceptance of out-of-wedlock birth, divorce, and single parenting kind of reinforce some of those trends. And so today, we find that young adults are less likely to maybe think about getting married because, after all, many of them grew up without a father and mother there as well. And so that's a real concern that many people have. I'm going to come back and talk about how to resolve some of that. But again, if you look at births outside of marriage, this goes from 1950 to 2010, and again, I'll update that to 2015 after the end of the year, you can see that that is increasing rather dramatically. Now, it is also a truism. If there is any law in sociology, it is this. If you grew up in a single-parent home, you have a very high percentage of growing up in poverty. And at first, the out-of-wedlock births were taking place primarily in the African-American community. Now they're taking place just as well in Hispanic-American, Anglo-American communities as well. And you can see that certainly there are people that have succeeded as single-parent homes. We have a presidential candidate by the name of Ben Carson, who grew up in perhaps one of the most difficult of circumstances. Abusive father, mother leaves, goes to Detroit of all places, puts them in a substandard school, but demands obedience from them, has them do a book report every single week, even though she can't even read some of them. And both he and his brother turned out to be outstanding individuals. So it doesn't mean that you are determined to do that, but it does, I think, suggest that the percentages are much higher indeed in that regard. So all of that kind of brings us to the 21st century family. U.S. News and World Report wrote this a while back, and I thought it was just apropos because it pulls together all the facts and figures we've looked at. And if you didn't understand all the facts and figures, again, they're on the website, but here's just a quick way to summarize what we've been talking about. On a spring afternoon, half a century from today, the Joneses are gathered to sing happy birthday to Junior. There's Dad and his third wife, Mom and her second husband, Junior's two half-brothers from his father's first marriage, his six stepsisters from his mother's spouse's previous unions, 100-year-old great-grandpa, all eight of Junior's current grandparents, assorted aunts, uncles-in-law, step-cousins, while Run Robot scoops up the gift wrappings and the other blows out the candles, Junior makes a wish that he didn't have so many relatives. The 21st century family that we find ourselves in today. Well, that brings us up to what we've just now experienced over the last couple of months, a changing definition of marriage and family because of a Supreme Court decision. And to understand this, let's go to Europe for just a minute, because Europe has been experimenting with redefining the marriage and family situations for some time, because you've either had same-sex marriage legalized or you've had de facto same-sex marriage. You also have had a very, very generous welfare state. And what has happened is this. More than half of the children in the Scandinavian countries are born to unwed mothers. 54% in Sweden, 49% in Norway, 46% in Denmark, 65% in Iceland. Essentially, we have a whole society there in these Scandinavian countries doing without marriage. Think of that. We're getting close in this country, but I wanted to show you the future if we head down this road. You have a whole generation of children growing up without any idea of what a traditional family might even look like. Now, why is that? Well, I've already tipped my hand. One of those is a very generous welfare state. We have somewhat generous welfare, but you have never seen a more generous welfare state in the Scandinavian countries where a woman can simply say, you know, I'm not really sure I need a man because the state is really taking care of most of the needs that we might have for me and for my children. The second one, of course, is that issue of same-sex marriage. Stanley Kurtz, at the now he's at the Hoover Institute, found that when the governments of Sweden and Norway permitted same-sex marriage, there was a sharp decline in the number of couples who wanted to get married. He also documented that also in the Netherlands, and I think it's reasonable to assume there. Why? Well, here's my suggestion. If you redefine marriage with counterfeit marriage, the real thing doesn't mean as much to you. Imagine right now if we went to the Dallas Museum of Art and all of a sudden we found that the money that we got in change after we got lunch, we went the next day, was counterfeit. First of all, we go back and say, I want my real dollars rather than the counterfeit dollars you got from the Dallas Museum of Art. But what if those counterfeit dollars started making their way all sorts of places, not just in the Dallas Museum of Art, but First Baptist and in all the various communities down there, and people get it from the symphony, and pretty soon it's in the Trammell Cole building. Pretty soon people don't know whether they have real dollars in their hand or counterfeit dollars in the hand. They tend to value the dollars they have less because the counterfeit affected the real. My argument is once you redefine marriage with counterfeit marriage, the real marriage doesn't seem quite as important. Where are we in this country? Well, this trend, how did we end up with same-sex marriage? Well, it turns out that first the courts in Hawaii and then Alaska actually had ruled that marriage, traditional marriage, was indeed unconstitutional because the laws actually were prohibiting same-sex marriage, and they were claiming that those laws were unconstitutional. So that set in motion a concern that if indeed either Alaska or Hawaii actually legalized same-sex marriage, at the time they just legalized civil unions in Hawaii, that that would begin to spread all through the country. So in 1996, the Defense of Marriage Act was signed by Bill Clinton after it passed Congress, and this clarified the full faith and credit clause, because they were afraid that if people could get married, same-sex marriage in Hawaii, then they could come to Texas and say, well, I'm married, and you should recognize this, or if they got divorced, require that Texas issue a divorce for a marriage it didn't recognize. So that stopped some of that for a short period of time, but by November of 2003, you had the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. The Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court ruled that indeed same-sex marriage could not be prohibited and should be allowed, and so by May 17, 2004, we have the first legal same-sex marriage in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And so then you began to see lots of things unfolding in various states, and that brings us up to June 26th of this year, in which the Supreme Court basically ruled that the Constitution guarantees a right to same-sex marriage. And so again, we can see how this has played itself out. But I wanted you to recognize that we're still maybe reeling from what happened back in June. Here we are in August. But a lot of that preceded it a long time before. And I think it brings us to some obvious conclusions. By the way, if you'd like some resources, I brought a few copies of my book, Signs of Warning, Signs of Hope. If you'd like to learn more about the changing American family, my book on homosexuality. But before we end, let's talk about what should we do? How should we as Christians respond, both individually and as the church here at Prestonwood Baptist Church? Well, it seems to me that first of all, we need to come back to a biblical perspective. And if nothing else, if you want to put down some of these key verses there, these are some things that I think we should just really begin to not only teach in our Sunday school classes, I think back to the issue of legacy. We need to instruct our children and our grandchildren in the important principles that I've put on the screen. The first is marriage is between one man and one woman. Even this last week when I was up at Michigan, we had a number of people saying, okay, what about this Christian camp? What about our church? Are we going to get sued? You know, are we going to be asked to perform same-sex marriage or something like that? I said, well, you could sue anybody for anybody, but that doesn't mean anything. Your success is going to be much higher if you put in your doctrinal statement, either at the Christian camp or in your church, that we believe that marriage is between one man and one woman. Genesis 2. Makes sense. Because at least then you can show that this is what we have. Then your bylaws say that we would not turn over our facility to anything that violates the doctrinal statement of this church. We would not turn over our Christian camp to anything that violates the doctrinal statement of this particular camp. The other issue is I put down Ephesians 6, that the context for nurturing children is in marriage. We recognize that families today do a very heroic job, and I salute any single mom trying to raise her kids without a father, without a husband. I understand that, but the reality is sometimes we have to speak clearly and say that it's really obvious from all sorts of sociological evidence, not to mention God's word, by the way, that children do best in a relationship between a father and a mother. And if you want to look at some of the refereed scientific journals, they've appeared in a database that the Family Research Council has, one that the Heritage Council has, and showing that if you just look at these journals, you can recognize in all these papers, they all basically say, you know what? The Bible's right. A father and a mother. That sex outside of marriage is wrong. You know, up until now, the word that I think the word culture sort of gets is, well, homosexual sex outside of marriage is wrong. But we don't really address the rest of it. And so again, I put down that particular part. And even teaching to flee sexual immorality. I mean, we're raising a generation, children and grandchildren today, where pornography is just a mouse click away. Where you can be watching television and all of a sudden you see something that you didn't expect. And so again, we have to really teach that. And then of course, not only a biblical perspective on marriage, but also a biblical perspective on family. And I put down Ephesians 5, 22 verses 6 to 4. Because these are very important principles that we need to pass on. More than that, even apart from the biblical evidence, I think we should also point out that social science today supports these biblical perspectives. One is that married people are happier, healthier, and better off. That's a subtitle of a book I'm going to mention in just a minute. That indeed, marriage is a good thing, and we should talk about that. That traditional marriages are good in terms of providing incomes and lower social costs compared to all these alternative situations. Married women are more likely to be happy. Traditional marriages have positive effects on children. And one of the points that I just made a minute ago is this book by Maggie Gallagher and others, Linda Waite. It's called The Case for Marriage, Why Married People Are Happier, Healthier, and Better Off. We can really make a case for marriage, and I think we're going to have to make a case for marriage not only from the Bible, but also make a case for marriage based upon all this enormous amount of social science research that reinforces the Bible. It's not the Christians that are out of step with the culture. It's the gay activists that are out of step with really where the culture should be. It's the people that are proposing free sex that are out of step with all the research that's come down. And this new book by Ryan Anderson, probably one of the more articulate defenders of traditional marriage, of Truth Overruled, in which he argues that we're going to have to be very careful to present a traditional marriage view and in some respects learn the lessons from what happened after Roe versus Wade on abortion. Because even though we would disagree with the abortion ruling, we were able to make the case that it was judicial tyranny, judicial activism. And number two, even if indeed you think that people should have the right to abortion, you should not force us to pay for it with our tax dollars. Which, by the way, has kind of surfaced again with these Planned Parenthood videos. Well, he's making the same case now. We need to argue that this case was judicial overreach, judicial tyranny. And more important, we should not force a baker, a florist, whatever that might be, an individual, a photographer, an innkeeper, to do something that violates their own particular viewpoint. And even this week, a ruling out of Colorado was very concerning about that as well. Finally, I think that we should also support ministries that strengthen marriage and family. And I certainly want to say that we have a great program here. By the way, if you know anybody that's thinking about getting married, I still think that the Before I Say I Do program here is really good. I've got three kids, and that program has broken up two of the relationships and confirmed another one. So, you know, it's good at not only confirming, in the case of my son and daughter-in-law, but also driving away and breaking up to others so really begin to make sure that you're on the same page. So we have some good programs here, but I might also mention Family Life. Next time Family Life has a weekend to remember here, I think it'd be great for you or to encourage other people to go and have a weekend to really focus on your marriage or marriage savers or some of those. And I think we should also, if I can be political enough, participate in the political process to pass laws that strengthen marriage and families. This week, Texas Eagle Forum gave its scorecard for all the representatives we have. And if you don't know, we have a lot of representatives from this church. And I was glad to see that all sorts of individuals got an A grade. So that was really encouraging to see that we just need to send more of those kind of people to Austin, send more of those people to Washington to make sure that we have laws that strengthen marriage and families. And again, if you're not familiar with some of those organizations, I thought I'd put that up there as we come to an end here. But Probe Ministries, we have lots of articles on marriage and family. Maybe some of these facts and figures, you'd like to read those again. I got some of those in my book, but you say, I don't want to read a book. I don't want to read a book, but I'd like to see some of that. You can go and see some stuff on Changing American Family on our website, which is all free. Heritage Foundation, I mentioned just a minute ago, they have what are called family facts. If you get into some kind of Facebook debate or some kind of discussion of somebody, say, well, I think it doesn't matter whether you have raised kids in a traditional family or a same-sex family. Go, oh, yeah? Would you like to see some of the facts and statistics? Because we've got thousands of very good refereed articles that all demonstrate that. And the few that have ever tried to say that, well, it doesn't make any difference. There was one study that said that actually children that were raised with two lesbian mothers did better than those in a traditional family. So we went back and looked at that and said, well, there's kind of a flaw in that. Because they came to that conclusion by asking the lesbian mothers if they thought they did a good job. Which is not a very good refereed scientific journal, but it appeared in the newspaper nevertheless. So, but again, if you want to find some of those facts, if you want to dig and really begin to build a case, that is an enormous database, a huge database called familyfacts.org. Family Life Ministries, I just mentioned that a minute ago, they come every year and do various conferences to strengthen your marriage. Of course, focus on the family, just saw family.org, and of course the new organization that Dr. Dobson is with, and Marriage Savers is another one. The good news is that we can't solve all the problems out here, but back to the key point, we need to leave a legacy. And so anything we can do to strengthen marriages and families within this church, within your extended sphere of influence, I encourage you to do so, because we really are in the midst of a battle, and I hope that we can be successful, and we will be if we trust in the Lord. Parker?